It's Backstage Pass with Steve Ryan. And here's your host, Steve Ryan.
I really appreciate you coming in and being in the house today. Kevin, you're like an artist's artist because you're so diverse. I mean, I was trying to figure out what your wheelhouse was, and it seems to be everywhere. Besides, you know, music, I mean, you're a singer, you're a drummer, I mean, you're film director, music video director, photographer, author. Art, I mean, you're kind of, you've got your toe in all the waters. What do you prefer?
Well, it's a funny question. It's all the same to me in a strange way. It's like it comes out of different taps. It's for me, it's all a creative process. And it bends to fit the medium that I'm working in. I don't know how best to describe it other than that. Making music is just about, it's sculpting air, essentially, into something that sounds interesting. And writing is making little symbols on a typewriter that does exactly the same. But I suppose the underlying factor or the thing that I want things to do is to affect people, is to move people or to stimulate people in some way. And I'm lucky enough to be able to do it in lots of different ways. I'm actually knackered when you told me that I do all that amount of stuff. It's tiring to hear it come at me like that. But yeah.
Is there one that you prefer, or does it kind of just depend on where you are in the moment? How do you decide which projects you're going to put on the front burner?
It depends what comes in and what's going on up here at the time, I guess. Yeah. I mean, so many of the projects I'm working on at the moment are self-generated. So I devote some headspace to this for a few days, and then if that is sort of settling into a nice groove, then I leave it alone and then I move on to something else if there is something else to move on to. I just have to be enthralled by it. It's as simple as that. I can't do anything. If someone says, well, can you do this? Let's say it's a music video, for example. If I'm not moved by the music or the artist doesn't look like they can give me anything or give the camera anything, then it's kind of, it's not going to happen. It has to be something that I want to make exist. Yeah, I think that's the bottom line.
When you talk about your music videos, I've got a collage from your website behind us of some of your music videos.
Yes.
And this is a music podcast, so I do want to dive into that. And I know that, I mean, people want to hear about 10cc and I'm Not in Love, and they want to hear about Cry, and you always answer those questions, so we can cover those. But really, Kevin, what really excited me about our conversation was your music video history, because you were okay. Kind of a pioneer. I mean, you were doing groundbreaking videos. You started before MTV was on the air, is what it looks like to me. And then some of most, I mean, if you look at, I think it was about 1981 when MTV debuted, and you guys had done a few videos, but most of the videos on that first day, because I went back last night and I looked at the first day of MTV's programming, and a lot of them were just concert videos. They were just, you know, guys on stage doing their thing, and it just was what it was. But people like you started coming in and added that creative element to it and made those videos stand out. I read that you kind of fell into it by accident.
Kind of. I mean, our background before being in bands, really, from the early 1960s onwards, both Lord Cream and myself were art students. And so we had a visual background, and we wanted to make films. We wanted to make, you know, we used to mess around with 8mm cameras and so on and so forth. But, we weren't studying that at college at the time. We were studying graphic design. So there was no outlet for that, really. And then suddenly we found ourselves in bands, and suddenly one of the bands was successful, and that kind of got put to one side. But there came a certain point, and I think we'd already left NCC, and there were stirrings of what you now call a music video, and they were mostly films made by artists or friends of artists.
Right.
That were shown on programs where you would normally expect a band to show up and play live. But if they weren't available, if they were on tour, then they would show some of these strange little films instead. So there was something going on. There was a way of expressing music in pictures that was sort of bubbling under. And we released a single as Godling and Cream called "American, an Englishman in New York." But we weren't a touring band, and so the only way we thought that we could promote ourselves was to maybe make a little short film. So we did a little storyboard and took it to the record label and asked if we could, and they said yes, but you can't direct it. We'll get a proper director, because we didn't know anything about directing or what cameras or what medium. And that's where it started, really. But just the experience of doing that, of being a part of that process, was like it set us on fire. A big light bulb went off over our heads and said, we can do this.
Yeah.
And when we started meddling, we started, you know, making suggestions that weren't necessarily wanted. And we found that we could. And we were sort of viewed to be responsible for the video for that piece of music. And people that were just coming up as musicians at the time, also on our label, wanted to work with us for the simple reason that any other people, or most other people making music videos at that time, didn't come from music. They came from like TV commercials or documentaries or so and so. And they didn't understand how to talk to musicians or understand the notion of turning sound into pictures, whereas seemed to be a natural thing for us, a natural progression. And then it all began to snowball. People were coming to us. And it was natural for us not to take any notice of what other people did. We didn't give a damn what other people did, because for the first time in our creative lives, we were at the beginning of a movement.
Yeah.
Don't forget any of the bands that we were in, including 10cc. You know, the English expedition to America musically was well in its stride. Rock and roll music had been out there for years and years and years, but. This was our moment, in a sense. Nobody really knew what a music video should be, so we sort of subconsciously resolved to tell them,
yeah,
or to show them.
And you did that. I read a quote from you that said, "If you know how it's going to turn out, do it another way."
You know what that sort of comes from? It's something Orson Welles said. When he made his first film, Citizen Kane, he said one of the most valuable commodities he had was ignorance. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you don't know what you shouldn't do. You don't, you know, you just go in there with a head full of potential and make it happen the way you see it. So it's an honest experiment. And
yeah.
That's how we felt. We didn't really have a clue. And we tended to, if we thought of an idea for a piece of music and it was something that we'd seen before, we rejected it because it seemed pointless for us to be doing that. We wanted to create things. We were doing it for ourselves. It's a selfish thing to say, but whenever we made a film, we wanted to be thrilled by the film. And we felt if that we were thrilled by the film, because we were hard to please, that other people would be thrilled by it as well. And that's kind of what drove us.
Well, I
still
I remember,
does, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one of the first videos that I can remember that you guys did that blew my mind. And I'm watching it. And I'm like, what is this? Was Herbie Hancock Rocket. And I think that was 83. And I mean, I had never seen anything like that.
Neither had Herbie. It wasn't an easy sell, but what happened was, you know, it was quite early in our directing careers, and we were always on the lookout for something. We'd been sent this wonderful piece of music, Rocket. I think it only just come in, but it was fabulous. And so we were, our ears and eyes were open for stimulus, and I saw this. This little segment on a news program on TV about an artist called Jim Whiting, who made these extraordinary animated sculptures that you obviously are familiar with. And I had one of the very early VCRs, and I pressed record and got a bit of it. And I showed it to Lowell, and we said, this is brilliant. We thought that this looks like that sounds.
Yeah,
and so we got Jim's address, and we went to visit him and talk to him about the project. I think somewhere between going to see Jim and after recording the piece of film and going to see Jim, we'd probably spoken to their management and the label about giving them a vague impression of what we were about to do, but maybe we didn't. I think back then, if they picked a director, if a band or a label picked a director to work on a music video, it was because they admired what they'd done before. There was no protocol where you had to submit a detailed treatment or a mood board or any of that bullshit. If they liked your work and you wanted to do it, here's a bit of money, go and make it. And I think it was a little bit more like that. So Herbie came over for a day, and we filmed Herbie's parts in our Media Lab offices. And he didn't know how it was going to be used. And he went back to the States, and we set about filming this madness over, I think it was just in a day. And we didn't do any to playback because these things weren't synced to anything. We just filmed the hell out of every one of these extraordinary pieces of art that Jim brought to the set in two or three different domestic settings. And we had no firm idea of how it would all cut together. All we knew was that what we were shooting was extraordinary. But we knew we kind of cut it together in a very kind of scratchy style to match the scratchy style of the sound. And it was a very long edit, a very long edit. You can imagine with all the stuff going on and where to place Herbie. We'd filmed him doing the whole piece of music. And it was an odd one because round about that time, there wasn't many, if any, black artists being shown on MTV.
Right.
So we were pissed off about that. We thought it was horrible. So part of our task and how we got from the brief we were given, which included, let's get a black act on MTV, to the point where we came up with this idea and we knew it would work. It was a way of showing Herbie as part of an overall concept as opposed to in front of the overall concept.
Yeah.
But we knew that there was something so bizarre and watchable about the whole thing, it would break that wall down.
Yeah. You like
and
pushing
it did
the
it
envelope.
All. Yeah, we like pushing the envelope. Yeah, we love that. We love sometimes it pushes back. But in this case, I mean, you know, when we sent it to, you know, the label and the management and Herbie, they didn't know what the hell they were looking at either, same as you. But it was a game changer.
Yeah.
Not only for us, but it seemed to break a hole in the wall that anything was possible in music video.
Yeah. Well, in speaking of pushing the envelope, you guys did Duran Duran Girls on Film.
Yeah.
And I mean, at that time, I don't think the original video, you could have pushed the envelope much further, because I don't think MTV played the original version here in the States.
Well, there were two versions. There was the clean version, which they did play, but the initial idea behind it wasn't just for a music video. They were very smart people, Duran Duran, including their management at the time. And at the time, music videos were being played in clubs.
Right.
And so this wasn't necessarily to be 100% directed for MTV. It was to be played in clubs. Therefore, we could have pushed the envelope a bit further, which we did for the extended version. And then when they were gathering some traction in the States and this needed to be shown on TV, there had to be a cleaner cut. It's as simple as that. But it wasn't directed at television or MTV initially.
Interesting you say that, because at that time I was a disc jockey in a nightclub that played music videos, and we probably played that two or three times a night, just because you just didn't see stuff like that. Obviously it was sexy and the song was great, and you know, it just packed the dance floor, you know, it worked.
Yeah, it did. It was great, and they're really good in it. I mean, they had a good time. It's very, looking at it now, it doesn't fit now. It would never get made now, I don't think. But back then, it was perfect for that time.
Around that same time, in between those two, you did Asia, Heat of the Moment. And the thing that I remember about that, that I'd never seen before, was all the scrolling across all those different monitors. And
that's
I mean, you guys just did stuff that nobody had seen before.
It was the heat.
That was how we got our kicks. And stuff like you're talking about was that kind of invention, was this kind of stuff that was invented in the edits. I think the secret was we treated making music video and editing music video the same as we treated making music. And that was always about having an idea for something, a song or whatever, having it partially written, going in a studio and playing around and experimenting to see what might possibly work, because recording technology was there. It was a fifth member of any band. It was there to bring something to life, and it can do that in a million different ways. And that's how we approached making music video. Very rarely we made a full storyboard and shot to the board. There always had to be an area in the shoot and in the edit that allowed for versatility, that allowed us to play and try stuff, because we didn't know what was possible. We had to experiment to find the sweet spot, should we call it, that made the thing come to life the way it should.
Is that how you came up with the idea of, I think you called it, I read it somewhere, the never-ending voices for I'm Not in Love with 10cc. Is that how that came about?
Kind of. We'd already started We'd already recorded the track once, but the treatment of it was pretty shabby. We'd recorded it like a kind of bossa nova lounge thing, and it was cheesy. But we kind of knew the song was good, so we shelved it and carried on recording other tracks for that album. And then at some point, because we knew it was a good song, we came back to it and we started talking about how we might approach it. And I, out of desperation, I said, "Well, why don't we do it all in voices?" And they went, "Well, what? What do you mean?" Well, no instrumentation as such, just all with voices, massive tsunami of voices against this lead vocal. And that got everybody thinking and how we might do it. And I think we tried just singing what you hear, but then, of course, you run out of breath after about 15 seconds. So we figured that the only way to do it, even though it was a rather long-winded way, was to create loops of us singing the appropriate notes to create the chords for the full song, which is pretty much what we did. It was a painstaking process. It's just a silly face I'm going through. Just because I call you up. Don't get me wrong, don't think you got it me. I'm not alone. But we did it. It took maybe a week, 10 days, or something like that. But there was a point where we suddenly realized what we'd made. Every time we made a loop, and we tracked three of us singing around the microphone, just one note, about 24 times, mixed that down to a quarter inch tape, and then fed that back onto one track of the 24 track machine. That's how it was done. And then brought that particular note through to one channel on the mixing desk. So each channel of the mixing desk became like a key on a piano. So we were playing the loops, we were fading loops in and fading loops out. Each of us was sat in a line across the desk with a given group of faders to operate to create the backing track. But before we got to that point, we did a very simple backing track with keyboards, guitar, and me playing bass drum on a synthesizer. And then we added the loops to that. And I think Eric sang the lead vocal while we were doing it too. Electric piano was added to that. Yeah. So it was very complicated, but very simple, if you know what I mean.
And I think
And it was.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, no, go on. Go ahead. You go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that opened doors for a lot of people. It reminded me, I was listening to that track yesterday, and it reminded me, it's like Fleetwood Mac must have listened to this. Lindsey Buckingham must have heard this, because I see elements, or at least attempts of that in some of their music.
Yes, I can see that.
Right. But you did direct your own video for Cry.
Yes, we did.
And that's a
Although
great, yeah.
it wasn't meant to be what you've seen originally, we were shy about making videos for ourselves. We weren't that comfortable making videos for ourselves. So the original idea was to film a couple of popular ice skaters in the UK called, I've forgotten their names now. It's not important really. To skate to Cry. Yeah, that was the original idea, to ice skate to Cry, but they weren't available when we needed to shoot it, so we had to come up with an alternative. So Cry, as you know, it was Plan B, and we thought, okay. A lot of different people can sing this song. It's the kind of song that anybody could sing, and the kind of emotion that a lot of people feel. Let's just get a lot of people in a studio and have them all mime to the song. That was it was kind of a throwaway idea. But that's what we did. We filmed a lot of people. We decided to do it in black and white, which I think was a good idea. And while we were doing it, you know, something clicked. And that thing was, if we lined the eyes up when we cut or mix from one to the other, it'll be interesting. But when we started to edit the results together, it wasn't that interesting. Just going from face to face to face to face. It was when we deployed a bit of early analog technology called a wipe, a soft wipe, which was mostly used sort of for captions stuff back then, whereby you can open the center of a picture up with a soft edge and reveal something underneath it, or go up or go down or left to right. And it's basically a way of revealing things. But when you've got two faces lined up and you reveal the one underneath gradually, what happens is it creates somebody that doesn't exist from face A to face B and to face C, and on and on and on and on. And as soon as we discovered that, it was like, wow. You'll see if you watch the video again, the first like maybe 30 seconds, it's just face to face to face, but at a certain point, that sort of gradual, almost morphing thing begins to happen, and you get these new faces coming in. And partially,
when you say that, it kind of reminded me of "Don't Look Back" by Fine Young Cannibals, where you had it all—you know, the guys were blurred, and then that one little strip came up until it got to their eyes, and then it opened.
Yeah. It's the way of revealing something that doesn't exist until you create the way of doing it.
Yeah.
And once we found that, the edit did go on all night, I think, for that, choosing which face looks better going from that face or a man to a woman or whatever, because we had a lot of possibilities to explore. But once we found the route, we knew it would have an effect on people. We didn't know it would be so profound, but it was.
Yeah, you have a unique relationship with U2.
I've done about four or five music videos with them, but I've worked. I filmed the Zoo TV concert in the States. The last one I did was something called "Stuck in a Moment," which we filmed in the States. That was the last music video I did for them. But I've done a few that I'm really proud of, yeah.
I was looking on your website, and there was this beautiful dancer that was dancing, you know, in this white dress that just flowed. And that was for their tour, right?
Yes, but it didn't end up being used. It didn't work. It was an experiment. They asked me to try something as an experiment, this technique. Well, but that's Morley Steinberg. That is Edge's wife.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And she's amazing. And we shot that in Dublin. And I think it was. I think it's beautiful. It works pretty well. All right. So the interesting thing about working with U2, period, is they are one of the few acts I've worked with who understand the power of the visual image.
Yeah.
You know, lots of people you work with are appreciative of what they get, but they don't understand before they get it of what it might be. And when I was working with U2, they always gave me plenty of leeway to try things. So this was something that I tried for something that they were doing. I don't remember which tour it was, but it didn't do what it was supposed to do in context of the actual structure of the show or the nature of that particular beast. But it was a technique which was to film something against black and then project it against other stuff, which was rather nice. And I used it on a video I did for Gavin Friday, and something I did for myself a good few years ago. But it's sometimes that happens. Sometimes you do something and it works creatively, but it doesn't necessarily fit the bill for what's required. But I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful. And it totally makes sense that you did stuff with them, because especially around the Zoo TV time, they were pushing the envelope visually as well.
Big time.
I've seen them in concert 4 times, all different shows that are, you know, different and unique in their own way. I saw them in the Sphere last year in Las Vegas, which blew my mind.
Everybody says that. It blew my mind. From the bits I've seen on YouTube, it looks astonishing.
Yeah, it was. It's hard to, unless you've been there, it's hard to even verbalize how magnificent it was.
Yeah.
I said I'd keep you about 20 minutes or so, and I've gone a half hour. I'm having such a good time talking to you. Are you okay continuing a little bit?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. Yeah.
Okay.
If you allow me to nibble between.
Absolutely.
You talking to me, so okay, sorry.
Absolutely. I didn't have any idea until I knew we were going to have this conversation. I knew about your video music production life, but I didn't realize how many biggies. I mean, you have worked with the who's of who's. And if you don't mind, I just want to let people know, because it blew my mind. I just want to read the I wrote it down so I would say it. But I mean, you did with Bono and Frank Sinatra. You did their video for I Got You Under My Skin. You've worked with Paul McCartney, Culture Club, Elton John, Sting, Kate Bush, Phil Collins. You did the Beatles' Real Love video. Eric Clapton, The Black Crowes, Rod Stewart, Snow Patrol, Lisa Stansfield, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Paul Young, Yes, Peter Gabriel. I mean, it just goes on and on. How many videos have you done?
No idea.
Yeah.
not as many as directors.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, no, it can't be as many. Because I don't know, but back then everyone was rushing to do stuff. We were more careful, more. We held back. We didn't do everything that came along.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Much like an actor wouldn't take on every role he's offered. Because we wouldn't do anything unless we thought we could give something to the music that meant something, or that felt like it meant something. That gave it something special. We, for better or worse, felt that a good video is one where you remember the video as much as you remember the music, and maybe one recalls the other. And if, you know, video as a medium has sort of passed its sell-by date to a certain extent now, whereas there are so many videos out there and so many of them are so terminally boring and unimaginative, but there is still an edge out there if you want to explore it. But we were always after that edge.
Speaking of one, for me anyway, that I feel like the video was just as good, maybe even better than the song, was Wang Chung, Everybody Have Fun Tonight. I mean, that was another one of, when I first saw it, it was like, what is this? I mean, the shakiness, and I'd never seen anything like that.
We did that because we discovered, and sometimes it happens, a new piece of equipment appears in an edit suite, and you think, oh, that's amazing. We can use that. And this was, it's almost like a programmable way of switching between shots. Normally back then in analog world, if you wanted to cut between this shot and that shot, you press a button from camera one to camera two to camera three to camera four, or you just do them as edits, or you'd mix between them with a paddle. But there was this suddenly this thing where you could program it to cut between, say, half a dozen different pieces of film every two frames or every four frames automatically for as long as you want. And we thought, okay, well, what would happen if we had a locked-off camera in one position looking into the corner of a room, and we had loads of different stuff happening in the room, but not everything was that different. Some of it was very, very similar, particularly the two guys in the band. But there was a lot of other mad shit going on in the background. That was kind of the thought, what would it look like? And it looks like animation.
Yeah.
It looks like stop frame animation, but it's not. It's all we did was we ran the song through a number of times, and we had this piece of technology cut between all takes every two or three frames all the way through the song. And we kept, you know, switching the takes that we were dealing with and then edited between the results of those takes. Impossible. I don't even think that tech is even used anymore these days, but for that moment in time, it was brilliant for that particular piece.
Yeah, I really do think that it made that song a hit. Yeah, I mean, it probably would have been somewhat of a hit, but I think it exploded because of that video. I was a disc jockey on the radio when that song came out, and we played a lot. We played it a lot. You know, the video just makes that song. There was another song that you did, Huey Lewis in the News, "Hip to Be Square," which I watched last night, and I had forgotten how almost uncomfortable it made me feel, but I couldn't stop watching. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it was so close. It's in your bubble, right? I mean, that's so close into your personal space, like down your throat, you know.
Yeah.
But you couldn't stop watching. It's like a crash on the side of the road. You know, you rubberneck it. You don't want it to see it, but you can't not look.
Who doesn't want to look down Huey's throat? I mean, come on. I mean, that's a perfect example of what I was saying. Piece of equipment shows up. What can we do with that? I know. Let's stick it down people's throats, down saxophones, etc.
Yeah.
Play it to the end of guitar. To us, that was obvious. You know, to other people, it was like a very technical, surgical piece of equipment, you know, which is probably what it was designed for. But we didn't think like that. I don't think like that. It's what can I do with this to apply it to what I do? And that worked really well. We didn't do many takes coming out of Herbie's Lab.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. You're going to do what? No.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I don't want to put you on the spot, but you've worked with so many artists. Is there somebody who really stands out to you that you just really loved, or something unexpected on a shoot?
Good heavens, that's a hell of a question. I mean, it's not. We had a very good relationship with the police. I think we did three really, really good pieces for the police when they were together, and they had faith in what we were doing, and they were really, really good to work with. They would do anything to make sure that the idea we were offering up was going to work. But there was one very bizarre shoot we did, and it was for a song called Wrapped Around Your Finger, which had them, and I don't think anybody had attempted this before. We had to concoct a way of doing it whereby the band were playing and singing apparently in real time to the music, but they were actually moving in slow motion. We came up with a way of doing that. I won't go into the technical details, but it actually meant that they had to perform the song to a highly speeded up version of Wrapped Around Your Finger. Now, the finished video is very elegant and everything is moving like so. But the shoot was insane because they were singing and playing it wrapped around your finger, and which is, you know, which is insane. And back then the tech didn't exist where you could tune it down to even sound in the correct key. It was Mickey Mouse all the way through all day for the shoot, with them running around playing, knocking candles over and doing this, that and the other. And they were knackered by the end of the day, as you can imagine. It was insane because the shoot and the mood of the shoot was the total opposite of what the thing looked like when it hit film and hit the screens. But their patience and their understanding of what we were trying to achieve was hugely gratifying. So working with them, I think, is great memories, and particularly, again, Synchronicity 2, I think it was called, was a big shoot at Shepperton Studios with towers full of drums and microphones and guitars. And it was very dystopian, almost Mad Max at the time. A great set and a great shoot, apart from one point where all the litter that was flying around, the newspapers and so on, caught fire. And they had to get the band out of the shoot very quickly, out of the studio. We had a little fire on that shoot.
Wow.
Which was, that could have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But thank goodness the right people were right there with the right tools to put it out. So working with them was a joy. I mean, but it's funny, you meet lots of people and directors say, oh, they were a real pain in the arse. Didn't like them at all. Such a big ego, blah, blah. We never ever, and I've never ever had that with anybody that I work with, because it's not acting. Playing music to camera is not acting. It's just giving of your all to the music, and it's about capturing that within the context you've created. And you have to create an atmosphere on the set that allows people to give you that, as opposed to giving them notes all the time. Shit. Let them be themselves within the thing that you're giving them to be themselves in. So I never experienced that. It's always been a joy. It's always been fun. It's always been something I'm grateful for being able to do and have done.
I had heard or read somewhere that you were looking at or wanting to direct a movie about Orson Welles. Is that still?
Yes, that's in the works, hopefully, at the moment. Whether, you know, it's like trying to put a movie together. One minute it's on, the next minute it's off. But we're beginning the process of moving towards doing that. Yes, I wrote a script a few years ago about Orson Welles, who is a big hero of mine. And yes, of course, I think anyone who directs anything would like to do something a little bigger every now and again and challenge themselves. And I think this would be a quite different project. I don't think there has been a film about Orson Welles quite like this one. So, I'm hoping that will come together.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like it might.
That's good news. I'll watch for that. Kevin Godley, we could go on for hours and hours. I hope that we can maybe get together and talk about more stuff, because I know we just kind of talked about your music video, and there's so much videos and there's so much more to you as an artist. I hope that we can get together and maybe do a follow-up and talk about other things somewhere down the line. I just want you to know how much I admire you as an artist, and I appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. I've enjoyed chatting to you and talking about myself, which I don't particularly like, but it's been fun. Thank you very much for having me.
For questions or comments, email Steve at steveryan.songoftheday@gmail.com.